Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
GoDamnMedia.com.
And you guys know that I always say that at the beginning of the program, and that is, yes, we do. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Cal Fritzy. I am so pleased that you could be here today to join me. I am very excited. Tim Burton, that freedom-loving infidel, is back today to join me on the program. He is right here. I'm going to bring him on momentarily, but just to remind some of my listeners who might be remiss in knowing who Tim is, he's a bit like Condell on speed. He really is. This gentleman from England is probably more informed about the issues of Islam than anybody I've ever had the pleasure to meet. He is absolutely on top of situations. He is living in England. He knows exactly what's going on in terms of Islam within England. He is a blogger. I put his links in the show notes. And for my archive listeners, please check out Freedom Loving Infidel, and that is Cat Strangler 101. He dislikes a lot of things, but what he dislikes the most is left-wing, loony, limp-wristed, mealy-mouthed, multicultural, politically correct, fluffy-body, brainless green liberals and new labor ignoramuses who prefer to go through life with their heads stuck up their nether regions rather than face having to confront reality. Tim also dislikes deceitful, sneaky, lying, duplicitous, weaselly, mendacious, dishonest, dissimulating, taqiyah-spouting Muslims and their demi-apologists in the mainstream media. But you know what he does do? He cooks a great chicken curry. And with that, I am going to bring on Mr. Tim Burton right now. Without further ado, I welcome you, Tim, to the program. How are you today?
Well, that's very kind of you, Kel. I'm good, thank you. And how are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm dealing with news all over the place, as usual. My goodness.
Oh, good. Yes. I saw you in the chat room yesterday. As you probably recall, I was on the EDL Blog Talk Radio last night. I had a minor technical problem last night, and I couldn't get to talk with the host until quite late on in the show. So I'm gratified to be able to speak to you at an early opportunity here on this show, Kel. I wouldn't have liked the same to have happened tonight. So it looks like we're all from a technical point of view. So it looks like we're all fine. Before I get started, I suppose what I really ought to do, you've made a great introduction to all your listeners about me, so thank you very much for that. I should just mention that I've made a slight change to my Twitter account, whereas people may previously have known me as MCAT. When I was on the EDL Blog Talk Radio last night, Tommy, one of the co-hosts there, made the observation that MCAT is actually a slang name for a substance of dubious quality. I don't know exactly because I'm not really well versed with drugs, but apparently if you take a lot of this stuff, it doesn't do you any good. So I thought, well, I can't have a name like that. So I'm still Catstrangler 101 on Twitter, but if you go to Catstrangler 101 and just take a look at my bio, you'll see it says at the top, follow that cat. And that's just what you ought to do. If you get onto Twitter and you have a look at my timeline and you like what you see, well, follow the cat. And that's the primary piece of news. It's not the primary piece of news. I'm only joking about that. Obviously, there's
breaking news.
There is plenty to discuss with all the things that have been happening with Islam this week. And before I get started, I just wanted to ask you, what has exercised you this week? Because there's certainly plenty that's exercised me, and I'll talk about that shortly.
Oh,
but
believe me, I have so much to share with you, Tim. But just getting back to your situation in which you had to change your Twitter name, I had to do the same thing with my Blog Talk Radio name. I used to be known as Red Fox Blogger of IAW, right? And then found out that the IAW also coincided with Israeli Apartheid Week, and I was getting people in the chat room saying, oh, what are you, a Palestinian? And I was horrified. So thus, I had to change my title of my program to Red Fox Blogger with Kel.
I said, yeah, you've got to be so careful, haven't you?
You do. Those darned acronyms, they just jump at you.
Yes.
But what's been exercising me this week? Oh, well, of course, we're having issues, and as always, we always do, what's going on over in the Middle East. But I don't want to delve on that too much because it's developing every single day. I'm listening to Barack Hussein Obama spout on his speech on Tuesday, but made me throw my cookies, and I think I had to take quite a bit of Alka-Seltzer that night. Dealing with the things like Christian children.
I take it that swearing, I take it that throwing one's cookies in in your part of the world actually means what it says. I mean, if we use that phrase over here, it would probably mean something quite different. But I know what you mean, because our President Obama has been making a right idiot of himself. I mean, I'm not an American citizen, okay, and I really feel for the American people, because I've thought for a long time that Obama has been less than a wonderful thing for the great country of America, and in the past few weeks he seems to me to have shown himself as a completely inept leader on the world stage. And I every time I talk to people about it, the phrase comes into my mind, and it's probably totally incorrect, but I mean, I'd say to people, I could probably do a better job myself running the country compared to him and the cronies in the Obama administration. To be fair, that's probably not quite true, but it amazes me that we don't seem to have an effective opposition in America that is standing up against the obvious tyranny of the Obama regime and the grave danger that he's putting the whole country in when he gets involved in these foreign adventures. I mean, he's talking about invading Syria, and even President Vladimir Putin has outsmarted him with his latest diplomatic initiative. But what made me laugh last week was when he referred to Obama's intervention in the Middle East as being like a monkey with a hand grenade. And quite apart from the racist overtones, I thought that was an extremely apt description.
Mm-hmm. I have somebody in my chat room, and that's Carrie Gunson. She begs to differ. She's saying that she thinks just about anyone could do better.
Well, okay.
You know,
fine.
Obama,
I mean,
Obama's administration, what it reminds me of is that old commercial with all those monkeys typing away on the old typewriters. They're sitting there and they're typing away. That's Obama and his administration. They're a bunch of monkeys sitting around typing away and making no sense whatsoever. I am very, very distressed, though, with Barack Hussein Obama and what he is doing on the world stage. Personally, I think that history will not treat him kind. He has proven himself to be the worst leader in terms of foreign policy that we have ever seen. What he has done in the Middle East is just atrocious. He has totally destabilized the entire region. He has collapsed Egypt, or he tried. Egypt is trying to fight back, but he collapsed Libya, and he's trying to collapse all sorts of other areas. Syria, what he's doing, what his involvement in Syria, quite frankly, frightens me, Tim.
Yeah, yeah.
Go
on.
Oh, I was just going to say that Assad, he is not the best leader, but he is still a sitting president. He's a tyrant, we know that, but he's still the enemy we know. And now Obama in this red line. Well, what was his red line? Well, he didn't draw that red line. The people drew the red line. This man backtracks all over the place, and you've got Hillary Clinton coming out, and she is coming out and talking about, well, we're going to investigate this and that and the other thing. Yeah, but they're going to investigate illegal animal smuggling. And I was listening to Vito Esposito on his program here on Blog Talk Radio on Monday night, and he brought that up as well, is that they seem to be more concerned about the illegal smuggling of animals, never mind the female genital mutilation, never mind the Christian children that were slaughtered in Syria.
Well, that's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I hadn't heard this about illegal animal smuggling, but I mean, it's just an example of, we'd say over here, fiddling while Rome burns, because, all right, nobody likes cruelty to animals, but it's hardly relevant when you've got what threatens to turn into a global war developing in the Middle East, to focus
exactly.
on something like that is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, Hillary Clinton, I wouldn't trust as far as I could throw her. I don't know if any of your listeners have read an article recently. I think it was in on American Thinker. Let me see if I can just bring this up. One moment. I'm pretty certain it was anyway. On American Thinker, which is one of the blogs I try to look at on a daily basis, mm-hmm. There was an article about how mendacious and duplicitous Hillary Clinton has actually been over the years. Yes, here we go. It's an article from a few days ago, written by somebody called Clarice Feldman. Now, that's not a writer that I know, but the article goes into a lot of detail about Hillary Clinton, to the extent that, I mean, lots of things I didn't know about how she rose to prominence, largely through cronyism and nepotism. And the things that she's done really just take your breath away. And if any of your listeners have a chance to look at the American Thinker website, it's just www.americanthinker.com. Have a scroll down the homepage and look at the article by Clarice Feldman. They'll find some things there that once you've read them, you just cannot understand how such a person could be in charge of anything more important than a hot dog stand, to be quite honest. Anyway, that's just my two cents about Hillary Clinton.
Well, that's exactly
I sense a stunned silence on the end of the microphone.
No, I was listening, and I'm totally agreeing, is that she is nothing but that's a perfect word. She's duplicitous. She is a phony, and it's cronyism that got her where she is today. And what she's going to do in 2016, quite frankly, it terrifies me. I thought that we were seeing the bottom of the rope and the race to the bottom when John Kerry became Secretary of State. Now we are faced with Hillary Clinton and what she is doing. And she had an epiphany about Syria, but she still cannot come clean about what happened in Benghazi. And to what did I get here? I've got something here. I don't like that. Something here. I got it. There we go. I don't know what that was. My apologies, ladies and gentlemen. I got myself a pop-up because I was bringing up something else. Gotta love those pop-ups, eh, Tim?
I've noticed one or two websites that I'd pull up. And in fact, you might mention this to Pamela Geller. I know that you're going to see her tomorrow, and of course we're all very jealous about that. But Pamela Geller runs a website, as you know, called Atlas Shrugs. And one of the things I've found, she puts a lot of really good articles on there, and I enjoy reading Atlas Shrugs immensely for the content that she puts up there. But one of the annoying things I found is that she has got one of these little pop-ups on Atlas Shrugs. And if you bring up Atlas Shrugs, you can be halfway through looking at an article, and this little pop-up will burst into life and start transmitting a stream of audio. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to listen to something else, or even if you're not, it's quite annoying. Now, she may or may not be aware of this, but if you get a chance over your cocktails and your half pint of lager and your packet of crisps tomorrow when you're talking to her, maybe you could just briefly drop it into the conversation. I don't wish to make light of it, because it's obviously a great honour to be able to meet somebody like that and to speak with them.
I
mention it just as an aside, really.
It's happening on all the websites too. And it's happening on Blog Talk Radio. I try to listen to programs in archive. And my office is in the basement. So what I do is that I have a Bluetooth speaker, and I listen through my speaker, and I bring it upstairs with me. It's a mobile speaker. and I pluck it on the counter in the kitchen, and I'll be maybe making supper or something, and I'm listening to something rather intense, whether it be from Radio Jihad Network or whether it be from any other radio host program, and all of a sudden they're drowned out because all of a sudden I'm getting solicited to engage in buying, a Lexus, or I'm being told that I can get a better rate on my credit card. It's like, what on earth is this?
Yeah, it's really annoying. I mean, with Blog Talk Radio, I suppose to a certain extent you don't have a great deal of control over it because as I understand it, you pay a monthly premium and you get the use of the platform, and you probably don't have much of a say if there's any pop-ups on there. But with something like Pamela Geller's Atlas Shrugs, which I think is an otherwise excellent site, I just find it a bit of a nuisance. It's not something that's enough to sort of turn me off the site or to make any criticism of it. But nevertheless, I'm sure if she's got somebody on her team who can handle a little technical issue like that, it would be worth doing. Because if I'm annoyed
there is something that people can do. There actually is some sort of application that they can use in that they can cancel that out at the very least where they're not getting the audio. But I've noticed, I have noticed on various blogs this last week in particular, when I visit, for example, Refugee Resettlement Watch, or if I visit any other blog as such, at the end of their article, they have a video, and you think it's accompanying the principal article, and it says about this video, and you think, well, you know, they put in a YouTube video to go with the article, and of course you want to explore further, so you click on it, and Tim, it turns out to be a 2-minute ad for something completely unrelated.
Real nuisance when that happens. Okay. Just regarding Pamela Geller, I presume it's all going ahead with the meeting tomorrow, but there was a problem, as I understand it, on the Friday night slot where you were hoping to get to speak to her, but there was some kind of an issue. What happened with that, Kel, if you don't mind me asking? Because I was all set to tune into that, but
no problem. I spoke with Pamela Geller afterwards. My show is in the evening, and she observes shul, and she couldn't be there, and she was hoping to be there Friday afternoon, and then the wires got crossed, everything got all mixed up. But I got a very nice email from her, a big apology, but it's really not her fault. It's my fault, because what I failed to do was get her contact so that I could phone her. It was just a big, huge mix-up, but she is really anticipating being on the program probably next week or the week after. She's on the road right now, as you know, she'll be in my neck of the woods tomorrow, and I'll be meeting her and Robert Spencer then. I'm looking very much forward to that. I'm going to another engagement tonight in Toronto where I will be meeting Gilad Shalat, and he is that young Jewish fella that was taken hostage by the Hamas.
Yeah, that would be a most interesting interview. I remember that quite vividly years ago at the time when the poor lad was taken by the Arab terrorists. And I thought, well, you know, that's the last we're going to see of him. I mean, I guess in one way he's very fortunate to still be alive. I know, obviously, they were hoping to trade him for a number of Arab prisoners held in Israeli jails, and they were willing to trade him.
The Hamas militants, they kidnapped him at the Israeli-Gaza border around that area, and they held him for over 5 years. They finally released him in 2011, late 2011, as a prisoner exchange deal. And they traded Gilad Shalit for over 1,000 prisoners.
Yes, I remember it quite
1,000 Palestinian prisoners. Yeah.
There were a lot of people that said, you know, it was a one-sided trade. And in some ways, you can see their point, you know, to exchange one Israeli for 1,000 Arab terrorists, it does seem one-sided. But I think more important is the symbolism, the fact that Israel was actually willing to put that value on his life in order to get him back. I mean, it speaks volumes for the humanity of the Israeli people compared to the people that they're up against. And I think that's at least as important as the argument that it was one-sided with one person against 1,000. I think to demonstrate to the world that your country has such humanity. I mean, Israel does this all the time. I'm a great fan of Israel, in case you hadn't noticed, or in case your listeners hadn't noticed.
Indeed.
You know, I think that it's so symbolic that they would do that. They would say, one of our own is so important that we're prepared to go to these lengths to get him back. And I'm so pleased for him. And, you know, it must have been absolutely horrendous for him during those 5 years.
Oh,
and
one
does wonder how he coped. And I suppose, you know, it would be nice to get his views on exactly how he managed to survive those 5 years without going mad, because
Canada is renowned for her support of Israel, renowned. Mm. And when Mr. Shalit was kidnapped, Canada was right up there on the world stage demanding that Hamas let him go. And we have, well, of course, as the rest of the Western world pretty much has, is that Hamas is a registered terrorist group. So when this came to light in Canada, not only did we cry for his release and do everything we could in terms of negotiation with Benjamin Netanyahu, but we are in the midst of making him an honorary Canadian citizen. So he's coming to Canada, and he's doing a cross-country tour, and one of his stops is in Toronto, and mm-hmm. he's doing that to thank Canada for their unconditional support. This poor young fella, he was held in isolation for over 5 years, about 5 years. He was mm-hmm. held. He had nothing. He was isolated. He had bare contact with the outside world. We demanded to know that he was still alive. Hamas would comply, and they would pluck him in front of a camera, having him show up the dailies with the date, of course.
Yep,
so we knew he was okay. But I remember that day when he crossed back into the bosom of Israel and what he looked like. And he could barely stand. It was just devastating. But to see him today, he's very much a strapping 27-year-old. He mm-hmm. is doing fine, and everything is all it's all good for him. I'm very, very pleased that his conclusion came to a happy end. Unfortunately, that doesn't always work for the people in Israel. And Kerrigan's, yeah, you're right, he was very frail. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's the thing. Israel loves life. They love life. As a matter of fact, when this is rather graphic, but people have to know this about Israel in particular, is that when they're attacked by suicide bombers, and of course they're coming over from the, I call them the fail-astinians, when they're attacked, when their markets are bombed and people are blown to bits, they pick up every single human wrap. This is how much they love life. This is how much they appreciate their people. This is how much they are resilient. And this is how much that they will let the Arabs know that you can try to break us down, but you will never destroy us because we are there. And Tim, I want to ask you about Queen Elizabeth in a few minutes, but I want to closing out on this, I was listening to a radio program yesterday, and one of the radio hosts mentioned that if Israel goes, so does the West. Because if we lose Israel, this could be it. This could be a full-blown World War III. Personally, I think we are engaged in World War III with Islam. But if Israel falls, what do you suppose would happen in the West? Do you suppose that it could spill over?
Well, I'm sure that it will. I mean, this isn't the first time I've heard this argument, and I totally agree with the statement that many people in the counter-jihad fight have made, that Israel is on the front line against the global jihad. And at the moment, the Arab world is saying, well, you know, if only Israel didn't exist, or rather if all the Jews were driven into the sea, then there would be peace. Well, that it just isn't true. It's just a pretext. And although I'm sure the Arab world would be very happy if Israel were wiped out and ceased to exist and all the Jews were driven into the sea, it would only be a preliminary move, because then they would attack every other target in the West in the same way that they've been doing up to now, but with renewed vigor, because the loss of Israel would give them such a morale boost, they would be emboldened to fight even harder against the West. So yeah, I mean, Israel is on the front line, and we should support Israel. Every rational thinking human being should support Israel against the savagery and the barbarity of the Islamic ideology. And the countries and the populations that support the Islamic ideology should be fought and resisted as much as possible. And people say, well, we're not in World War III. You've made that very point that, in fact, you know, it could be argued we are in World War III, because this is a global fight against Islam, which isn't going to go away after overnight. It's something that will encompass generations long after you and I have gone. I believe we'll still be fighting this fight. I have every confidence that because we have truth on our side, once enough people realize that we are doing the right thing, that Islam will actually be quite easy to contain, if not actually drive off the face of the earth. It will be an easy thing to contain. But at the moment, we've got so many people who swallow the disinformation that's being spread in the mainstream media in virtually every Western country, the disinformation that says Islam is a religion of peace, it's no threat to Western democracies, that Islam can coexist with Western democracy and Western civilization. That news coming out of the mainstream media is relentless. And, of course, a lot of people want to believe it because the truth is really scary. The truth is that Islam will devour us, will destroy everything that we hold dear, will crush all the values that we think so highly of if we let it. And I was making this point only yesterday on EDL Blog Talk Radio when I was talking with Tommy and Jeff. One of the things that came up was, I forget who mentioned it, it might even have been me, one of us said, we have truth on our side, which is true, we do. And if you've only really got to apply rational analysis to any argument concerning pretty much any aspect of Islam, whether it's the Islamic scriptures or whether it's the things that are happening in the various countries and the reasons behind them, the Islamic countries, you've only got to apply rational analysis to see that we do in fact have the truth on our side. When we say that these things are the result of the Islamic ideology being interpreted by Muslims around the world, we're telling the truth. I mean, Muslims will say, no, Islam is perfect. It's if Muslims do bad things, then blame the individual Muslim. Well, no, it's not as simple as that. It's nothing to do. Well, when I say it's nothing to do with individual Muslims, what I mean by that is to take an analogy, if you look back to World War II, and you saw an individual group of Germans in the street doing bad things, you know, stringing up villagers and shooting people mm-hmm. for no reason, you would not move to prosecute individual German soldiers who you caught doing that. You would go after the German war machine, and that is what we did in World War II. We went after the German war machine, and we eventually defeated the German Nazi ideology. Well, the analogy is, of course, that there is an Islamic ideology behind everything that we're seeing in the world today, and pretty much every country where Muslims have a substantial population, they are spectacularly misunderstanding Islam in the same way in every country. And we shouldn't be going after individual Muslims. It's not enough for Muslims to say, oh, individual Muslims do bad things, but Islam is perfect. We have to say, no, Islam is the driving force behind everything that is happening in the Western world and in Muslim countries that is really contrary to basic notions of humanity. And Islam is behind it. And Islam, if we can't wipe it off the face of the earth, we do at least have to contain it so that the damage that it can cause to the rest of humanity, who still retain a certain sanity, is minimized. It can be done, but we have to make everybody realize that it needs to be done. And that's the purpose of, it's certainly what I see as my purpose, to bring that point of view in a persuasive manner to as wide an audience as possible.
Absolutely, and I could not agree with you about that, you know, any further than I could. Tim, I do have an issue, though, when it comes to Muslims and their adherence to Islam. I hear these organizations that say, well, you know, it's not the Muslims. And I listen to arguments, and people say things like, well, there are stages of Islam, and, for example, there's the lapsed Muslim, and there's the sleeping Muslim. But when the strength in their numbers grow, that is when the sleeping and the lapsed Muslims will start to wake up, because they do eat, sleep, drink, and live Islam. They live by the dictates of the Quran. Personally, I do not believe in a secular Muslim. I think if you're a Muslim, you're either in or you're out. I'm a Christian. I'm in. I can't ignore the teachings of the Bible, for example. I have to adhere to that Bible. And if I am in a Christian majority, well, so be it. I am adhering to the dictates of Christianity within the country of which I reside. Now, Muslims, they are outsiders living within the inside of Christian states, England, Canada, the United States. They're a minority at this point, but we see the Muslims, and in particular, people most familiar with would be Taqiya. However, we see what's happening in the White House in the United States, in particular with Barack Hussein Obama and his stacking of his higher echelons within his cabinet. Now, I'm just doing a roundabout here, but people say, no, there is a such thing as moderate Muslims. I personally do not believe that. I know I feel bad for Muslims. I do not hate Muslims. I am not a racist. I am not out to gun for the Muslims. I am here to just say that is Islam. And Tim, you just nailed it. You just totally backed up my, well, rather mm-hmm. roundabout argument.
I agree that when it comes to talking about moderate Muslims and moderate Islam and so on, the mainstream media would have us believe that the radical Muslims are only a small percentage of the total Muslim population, and therefore we shouldn't tarnish or we shouldn't paint an entire peaceful religion with the same brush. And in fact, that was an argument that was made at the Oxford Union not long ago. There was a discussion from earlier on in the year about whether Islam is a religion of peace or not. Now, that is that was actually quite an interesting discussion, and it is viewable if people want to look at it in its entirety on YouTube. Just look for the Oxford Union discussion on whether Islam is a religion of peace, and you'll see various speakers who put forward arguments on both sides. But that what I was getting round to on that was you can't really say that the Islamic ideology has been hijacked by radical Muslims, because the Islamic ideology is the entity that is responsible for everything that we see that's happening in the world today. And the moderate Muslim, who may well be just somebody who doesn't particularly want to get involved politically, he maybe just wants to live a quiet life, bring up his family, educate his children, earn a living, and just basically keep his head down. All well and good. If he if he still self-identifies as a Muslim, then really he's got to expect that the rest of us are going to look on him with great suspicion. And what's another good analogy here? If the fact that he doesn't personally go out and commit jihad, or he doesn't strap on a suicide belt, or encourages his children to go out and kill infidels, well, that's well and good. But on the other hand, how many times have we seen so-called moderate Muslims take an active stance in their community to deter other Muslims from becoming radicalized? Now, some years ago, Robert Spencer posted on Jihad Watch ways in which Muslims might avoid Islamophobia, because Islamophobia was a relatively new word then, and he made the point then, as now, that in fact it's a made-up concept and Islamophobia doesn't really exist, because it's not an irrational fear of Islam. We're concerned because of what Muslims do. It's the behaviour of Muslims that gives rise to fear and concern, and it's not an unjustified fear and concern like the word Islamophobia would apply. But he put a series of steps on his Jihad Watch website saying if Muslims undertake these steps, then Islamophobia will virtually disappear. And one of those steps was that Muslim groups all over the world, if they instituted programs to teach against totalitarianism, Islamic totalitarianism, Islamic supremacism, to teach against the idea of violent jihad, to teach against the idea of violence against the infidel, to teach against violent parts of the scriptures in Quran and Hadith, if those programs were instituted on a worldwide basis, in order to, and they were open and transparent, and everybody could see that this was what Muslims were doing, then Islamophobia would largely disappear, because we could see, yeah, there's a problem in that community, but they are stepping up to the plate and they are taking care of it themselves. But that isn't happening, and you don't get Muslims standing up and denouncing their co-religionists to the authorities. The plots that have been detected in Western communities have largely been detected in spite of the Muslim community, not because of the Muslim community supporting law enforcement, but in spite of the Muslim community not supporting law enforcement. And that seems to be such a problem that we are going to get to the point where we're going to have to say, if you are not with us, then you are against us. And I think the time for actually saying that is long past due.
I have noticed that we seem to be giving Islam quite a pass, especially since 9/11. I'm very concerned about the direction in which we are going as a so-called demi-state, if you will, in that I find that Muslims are becoming, well, Islam well, globally, Islam is quite emboldened. But I notice locally, within our own respective countries, that Islam is becoming quite emboldened in that they are pushing their agenda very well. I brought this up on my program last week in that I said we had a chance to really explore the nefarious ambitions of Islam when the explanatory memorandum was written in 1928 and finally exposed to the West in the 1980s. We had a chance to do something about it then. We had a chance well over three decades ago when the explanatory memorandum as written by the Muslim Brotherhood was discovered, but we did nothing about it. And we have world leaders. We have very, very powerful world leaders in the West that are enabling within the dimitude attitudes that Islam is indeed a religion of peace. We have people like Barack Hussein Obama. We have people in your country, Tim. We have David Cameron engaging in Islam is a fine religion and espousing
yes.
the fact that it's not the Muslims. They're not addressing the elephant in the room, and that elephant is Islam. The elephant in the room is Islam, and the politicians, the powerful ones that lead our very countries, are ignoring it. We have a prime minister here in Canada, Stephen Harper. He is trying to address the issues of Islam within Canada. Unfortunately, we have a charter, and we have official multiculturalism, which means all cultures are equal, and that includes Islam, despite the fact that they follow something very nasty called Sharia law. They're not Sharia law, of course, technically is illegal, but it seems that when Sharia crimes are committed within the West, they get a pass because it's their culture, and we simply have to understand that they don't understand the rule of man. But they don't recognize the rule of man, Tim. They recognize the rule of the Quran. They do not. We have cases, well, in the United States, and I'm sure you have them in England, Tim. We have a couple of cases, in fact, going on in Canada. That was the VIA potential bombers. They were trying to blow up a VIA train en route from Toronto to New York. There is one defendant who refuses to be tried in a court of law in Canada because he does not recognize our man-made law. These are people, too, that we're importing into our countries. These are people
oh, yeah.
that come here legally, and all of a sudden they turn all jihadi on us. I mean, for goodness sake, look at Nidal Hussein in the U.S. military, the Fort Hood shooter. All of a
yes,
sudden,
yes,
it's
indeed.
Jihad.
It is, and well, there are several issues which you've raised here. I'll try and take them one at a time. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We have the same sort of problems over here with our leading politicians who refuse to recognise the truth about Islam, and they will do anything they can to sweep it under the carpet.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the big example just recently was the murder of the soldier Lee Rigby in Woolwich.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that David Cameron did was to stand up and say, of course, this had nothing to do with Islam. Islam is a religion of peace, and what happened was a criminal act. All right, it could be termed an act of terrorism, and I think he almost had to be dragged kicking and screaming to use the words, it could be termed an act of terrorism. But the point is that he wasn't going to align himself with the position, the obvious common sense position, that Islam had everything to do with it. And we know this because when the chap who murdered the soldier in the street was caught on camera shortly after the murder with holding a machete, a blood-stained machete, in his blood-stained hands, he was quoting the Quran chapter and verse and saying, this is why I did what I did, because the Quran commands that we fight against the infidel. And I think he either quoted verse Quran chapter 9 verse 5 or chapter 9 verse 29. I forget which, but the point was that it was one of the violent verses, and he made it quite clear that that was his motivation. And yet the following days in the media and from the mouths of politicians, we had statements like, you know, it's difficult to understand this guy's motivation. And I was pulling my hair out and saying, no, it's not at all difficult, to myself, I would say. But, yeah, you're absolutely right on that. We have a huge, huge problem with the mainstream media and the politicians on both sides of the pond, well, in pretty much every Western country, who refuse to recognize anything other than the official line that Islam is a religion of peace, and that will have to change. It'll probably take something far worse than 9/11, I'm sorry to say, before the position of the politicians and the mainstream media does change. I wish it were not the case, but that's the way it's looking to me, that it's going to take something absolutely huge.
I agree with that. In what you said, that it may take something far worse than 9/11 to wake up the populace in that there is a serious problem, that Islam is not a religion. It's a political entity, but they're a political ideology wrapped around disguising as a religion, and they are on a so-called holy war. Now, what's it going to take after 9/11 was the most devastating thing I have ever witnessed in my lifetime and probably will. You're right when you said beforehand a little while ago that this is going to go on for years and years and years and years, and it will not be resolved within our lifetimes. But what happens within our lifetimes? What happens down the road? Something more devastating than 9/11. For example, what if they infiltrate our water systems and our children start to die because they're drinking water and they're getting sick and they're not getting out of that coma? They're not coming home again. And this happens upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands, for example. And that's just one tiny example I can think of on my amateurish little head.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, you've got a very good point there. The thing about our civilized Western societies is that they are built on trust, and what we do is we largely trust our fellow man to behave in a civilized way towards us if he's going to live in our society. We've always, ever since Western civilization developed, we've always recognized that there are people who don't subscribe to this, but we didn't, until very recently, import those people into our societies and allow them to do exactly as they pleased. Not to go too much into the detail with America and Canada in particular, but thinking of my own country, Britain, it was only up until about, if you look at the history of Britain up to about 60-odd years ago, we only ever had, in between the time of the Norman Conquest in 1066 and, I don't know, the end of the Second World War in the 1940s, or maybe going a bit further on to the 1950s, we only ever had about 250,000 immigrants in that time. I'm talking, you know, 900-odd years almost, and we only ever had about 250,000 immigrants. Now, that's a statistic that I only found out recently that quite astounded me. But if you look at it in that light, since then, we've had politicians of various stripes have decided to import immigrants from various parts of the world into Britain, totally swamping the indigenous population and imposing, in the name of multiculturalism and political correctness, imposing things on the indigenous population which they would never have voted for in a million years. And the first thing we have to do is to make people realize that the concepts of political correctness and multiculturalism are nothing more than a smokescreen to allow unfettered immigration and to try and make us accept things that we would otherwise never in a million years would have accepted. And I'm talking ideological values, okay? Everybody says, well, what is one of the great values or one of the great characteristics of the British people, and most people would say pretty much first off the bat, they'd say tolerance. And it's certainly true as far as I'm concerned. Everybody that I ever grew up with in when I was at school and into my adulthood, you could accept people who were different from you, and that's fine as long as they broadly subscribe to the system of values that glues our civilization together. But when you start importing large numbers of people whose values are so totally different, it drives them to try and disassemble our civilization, and our politicians actively encourage the breakdown of our civilization, then what lies ahead is going to be anarchy. And you only need to look at countries like Syria and Lebanon to see what form that anarchy can take.
And exactly.
And just there's two things that I'd just like to say about that. One is that I was listening to Vlad Tepes on the EDL Blog Talk Radio last week, and he's got a link to a video on his site, which I, off the top of my head, is I think it's called VladTepes.com.
Oh, Vlad Tepes,
should be difficult to find.
And that reminds me. That reminds me. Tim, I'm just going to totally interrupt. Vlad Tepes is a very, very prolific blogger, and he's a regular contributor to the East Anglian's EDL radio show, and he's there every Friday at Jeff's show. So you want to listen to the East Anglian's EDL radio show at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Fridays. Also listen on Thursday and Sunday. But Vlad Tepes, happy birthday.
Oh, it's his birthday. Yeah, well, happy birthday then, Vlad, if you're listening. But the point I wanted to make is that on his website, he's got a very, very powerful video concerning Syria and what happens when you take away the civilized structure. All right, we could talk about how civilized and democratic Syria was before they had the civil war, but the point is that when you get a vacuum of power, like they're starting to do in many parts of Syria now, what comes in its place with the Islamist rebels setting up Sharia courts and imposing Sharia law is not a pretty sight. And that's what would happen even in a country like Great Britain if we took away the civilized values that we have built up over the last 1,000 years and left a vacuum. What would happen would be the Islamist the Sharia law imposed by Islamists would very quickly rush in to fill that vacuum, and we would all be the poorer for it. And I'm not just talking about Muslims, I'm talking about non-Muslims too, because I'm sure your listeners know, Sharia law is not just a system of law that's applicable to Muslims. It has a lot that's applicable to non-Muslims, and that will be imposed by force on non-Muslims if Muslims have the power to do so. That's all they need. They just need the power to do it, and they will do it. And on the back of that, that's a very good argument, I might add, for making sure that Muslims are never allowed in Western countries to exercise political power. Now, I know that's a very discriminatory thing to say, and I've been taken to task about it before now, but the fact is that if you allow Muslims to exercise political power, or in fact power in any related branch, I'm not just talking about national politics or local politics, I'm talking about in the military, I'm talking about in the judiciary, in the criminal justice system. If you allow Muslims any form of power in those areas, they will abuse that power, because their loyalty, first and foremost, is to the Islamic Ummah. And if push comes to shove and they have to make a decision which is going to compromise their loyalty to the Islamic Ummah, they are going to find it very hard to support the infidel against against that loyalty. And just for that reason alone, we have to shake off the political correctness and multiculturalism that has infected our Western societies and say we are not going to accept the presence of, until such time as Muslims get their act together, which, that's not going to happen overnight. Until such time that they get their act together, we are not going to be able to allow you to exercise power in those areas, military, judiciary, or political systems that we have in the West.
I have to expound on what you are saying, and especially in the avenue of political power. Ladies and gentlemen, this is how individuals within the realm of Islam start out and how they build their political careers. They start out as community organizers. They start out as getting on the local school boards because they're parents, and then they run for city council. They get their bona fides in those avenues, and then all of a sudden they're running for provincial politics or state politics, and then they become more powerful, and then they become runners, and they become influential runners within the federal political system. We are seeing this all over again all the time. As a matter of fact, Tim, we have one politician in particular that worries me greatly, and he's the mayor of Calgary, and his name is Nihad Nenshi. He is an Imadi. He is very much vocal about the rights of Islam within Canada, and he is also Justin Trudeau's best friend, and Justin Trudeau is the federal leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. This sort of thing worries me. When I see these people, these Muslims, getting voices, and they're making the national dailies with their opinions and their swaying opinion. But what they do too, Tim, is I've noticed this trend, is that they are great people because, for example, 2 months ago, Calgary, Alberta, suffered a devastating flood. And the mayor, he stayed up for 48 hours straight helping everybody out. And then he got all the photo ops, and he was there with his sleeves rolled up, and he was helping the people, and he was a wonderful man. But you know what? I'm telling you, Tim, I wonder sometimes about the hidden ambitions of these Muslims when they reach the levels of politics that these people are capable of.
Well, yes. I mean, that's... I suppose the behavior you're describing, you could look at it on one level and say, well, that's just a typical politician who's going to never let a good crisis go to waste and will take every opportunity to build up his profile on the back of human suffering. I mean, that's just a typical politician, you could say, on one level. But yes, there is a particular case when you're talking about Muslim politicians, if they can consolidate the power when they're in a position where the non-Muslim population have their guard down, then when Muslims become more numerous, which of course they always do, because the demographics are such that they will have many more children in a typical family than a non-Muslim family will. As Muslims become more powerful, more numerous, if they have political representatives who are themselves Muslim, and those Muslims give priority to other Muslims in the population. I mean, that is just nepotism. Well, no, not nepotism. It's cronyism and corruption, because a non-Muslim politician would not normally, or one wouldn't normally expect to see this, he wouldn't normally take religious affiliations into account when deciding how best to treat the people in his constituency or in his parliamentary area. He would try and treat everybody equally, and that, you know, in a democracy, that's what it comes back to. When I was talking about, we have a level of trust in our communities, and we expect that people who are elected to these high positions hold themselves accountable to the very highest standards and treat everybody equally, and that simply will not happen with Muslim politicians. You will not get. I I would put money on the fact that when push comes to shove, if a Muslim politician has the opportunity to advance Islam at the expense of non-Muslims and thinks he can get away with it, he will get away with it. He will do his best to get away with it. And that's why there's a good case to be made until such time as Islam is firmly under control, if not eliminated altogether, which it might be a tall ask, but it's still possible to contain and control at this stage. Until that happens, we should be taking a long, hard look and saying, I'm very sorry, but if you subscribe to this ideology, we are going to have to treat you with suspicion, and that is going to include not allowing you to serve in political roles or to have a role in the judiciary, the military, the criminal justice system, or anywhere where your vote or your power might affect non-Muslims disproportionately and adversely compared to your Muslim co-religionists. We are going to have
absolutely
to say that.
Absolutely. And you know what? We're overdue for a little bit of a break, but what that quote that you recited, never let a crisis go to waste, yeah, that was Rahm Emanuel, as a matter of fact. He's the current mayor of Chicago. Isn't that funny? Obama's stomping grounds, and he was Obama's chief of staff.
Yes.
Oh, I'm telling you. Yeah, he coined that term. Yeah, never let a crisis go to waste. Rahm Emanuel, my oh my. But I am going to let you come up for air because I am keeping you for another 55 minutes, if you don't mind.
I shall go and refresh this mug of coffee I have here.
Okay. So. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Tim plays the guitar. Tim used to play the violin. Tim no longer plays the violin because to hear him play, it would sound like he was strangling a cat. So now he's playing the guitar. But I know that you like blues, and I know you like American acoustic. So I found a song for you that I'm going to play for you, Tim, while we all take our break. Tim, I hope you enjoyed this. It's from Jackson Browne.
Okay,
and
great.
We will see you guys back here in less than 4 minutes.
when I get you then it's free. Baby, I'm the cat. Baby, I'm my Santino back. The gypsy woman prophesied, but the advice, I'm the cat. Baby,
to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. And just to remind you, my guest today is Tim Burton, and that is the Freedom-Loving Infidel. I want to thank Tim very much for his precious time that he is spending with me. This is a very, very busy individual, and I do not want it to go unsaid that I met this man, and I loved his blog. He also has a Twitter account. I have all of Tim's links up there in the show highlights, and that is where my archive listeners, where most of my listens come from. I want to thank people who are in my chat room, and I want to thank people who are listening on other devices, and I know you are, and I know you do, and I know you will. Tim, welcome back. Oh, hang on, Tim. I got something here. Oh, what's that? Uh-oh. There she goes again, Tim. And I better bring Tim back on.
Hi there, Kel. Yeah, yes, of course, there's a story behind that that little clip of music there. Do you want to sort of go into it, or shall I briefly?
Oh, Tim, your analogy of why that we are literally on a Titanic is, you'll do it much better justice than I could ever do.
Okay. Well, I'll briefly summarize then for your listeners. When I was last on the show with Kel, I made the point that we had got a huge advantage over previous generations in some respects when it comes to dealing with Islam. Now, if you look at the advance of Islam over the last 1400 years, and if you want to do that, there's lots of links on the internet. There's one in particular that you could start with called The History of Jihad, and that's a website that summarizes the Islamic conquests over the last 1400 years. And of course, one of the things about why Islam was so successful was people didn't really know what had hit them until it was too late. They didn't realize the implications of the Islamic ideology and the havoc that it could wreak on the civilizations that existed in the last 1400 years. And as a result, when Islamic hordes poured out of Saudi Arabia in the 7th century and expanded across North Africa and across the a great deal of Asia, going down as far as India and beyond, they were totally unprepared for it. And they were certainly unprepared for the fanaticism of the Muslim warriors, because say what you like about Islam, if you wanted to produce an ideology that would you could implant into the heads or the minds of your warriors so that they would be totally fearless and they would attempt to destroy everything that came in their way regardless of their own personal safety, if you wanted to do that and develop an ideology that would destroy everything in its path, you would be hard put to do better than Islam for that purpose. And the civilizations that encountered Islam over 1400 years, by and large, with a few notable exceptions, fell not like dominoes exactly, but they found it very difficult to resist the Islamic advance. We have a huge advantage in the information age that we currently find ourselves in with the internet. We are able, at the click of a mouse, to be able to find out things about Islam that we could never have done in the past without a great deal of research. I mean, when I was a young lad, if you wanted to find out anything at all, you went down to your local library. And you took out a book and you read up on your chosen subject, and if you were encouraged by the right sort of teachers, you would write an essay about it and hand it in at school, and that was the way you learnt. And it's the way that most people over the preceding years used to learn as well. They would rely on books. I mean, before we had books and the printing press, they would rely on word of mouth from people coming round from village to village, town to town, and so on. And the spread of information was very slow. So that when these civilizations, as I say, when they were hit with the Islamic advance, it was very difficult to coordinate a response that would be strong enough to stand up to it. But now we have the information age, and we can find out a hell of a lot more. I used an analogy when I was last on Kel's show about the Titanic. And in the analogy was that we, as the rest of the world, are on the Titanic, and the Titanic is heading towards this huge iceberg, which represents the Islamic threat. Okay, bear with me on this, people. I think it won't take too long. And one of the things that stopped caused the Titanic to actually hit that iceberg and sink was the fact that the people who were guiding the Titanic, the crew and the captain and so on, didn't see the iceberg until it was too late to change course. And of course, if you've got a huge ocean going liner, you don't change course on a sixpence over here, you'd probably say on a dime. The point is that if you see such a thing and you want to avoid it, you've got to be a good few miles away to be able to stand a chance of manoeuvring the ship in time. Anyway, bear with me, as I say. And I look at the internet as being a kind of fog-dispelling device which allows us to see the threat well ahead of those people in previous civilizations who, as I say, didn't really know what had hit them until it was too late. We actually have a huge advantage in the internet. It allows us to see exactly what Islam is all about, and it allows us to share ideas in a way that never would have been possible even 20 years ago. It wouldn't have been possible to share information in that way and to expose Islam for what it really is. And that's why I say that even though the situation looks dire in as much as Islam has been emboldened and it seems to be advancing in every country in the world where there are growing populations of Muslims, the awareness of non-Muslims or the ability of non-Muslims to become aware has never been greater. And that's what I meant when I referred to the internet being a fog-dispelling device on the Titanic. And when I mentioned this to Kel, she said, right, that's going to be your theme tune from now on. I'm going to dig up this clip of Sweet Dion playing the Titanic theme, and that's how we're going to introduce you. And I said, well, okay, I'm happy with that analogy. If you want to use that little clip of music, and which you just did, then that's the reason for it. So just a brief explanation, but it's an analogy. I as people who know me and know the way in which I argue and discuss on these radio shows will know I'm very big on analogies, and I think analogies are useful because It allows
us think they're storytellers.
Yeah, that's right. It allows us to explore and explain concepts which people might otherwise find difficult to understand. So I use them a lot. So I hope your listeners will forgive me for that particular analogy with the Titanic and the internet as the fog-dispelling advice as the Titanic approaches the Islamic iceberg. But I think we have every opportunity to avoid running into that Islamic iceberg head on and
You know what the Muslims will say. You're a Titanophobe.
Yeah. Well, quite so. I'm very proud to be a Titanicophobe as a result.
Titanicophobe. I like that.
Or more, I suppose, an icebergophobe. But that sounds slightly uncomfortable to get my teeth around. So I think we'll stick with Titanicophobe and leave it at that. But yeah, that's the story behind that. So anyway.
I just love it. When I was talking with you earlier last week, I was asking you about Queen Elizabeth because I explained to you that I was listening to Jeff's show, and he had an American caller, and that's our dear sweet Sue from New Mexico, in fact.
Yes.
And she was asking Jeff about the opinions of Queen Elizabeth and when it comes to Islam, and I asked you about that, and I am a subject of the Queen as well, so I'm quite aware of how she has to conduct herself politically. She really cannot say a whole lot. However, she did have a few words to say. She was talking with security correspondent Frank Gardner one day, and she was talking about the radical Muslim cleric Abu Hamza. And she wasn't necessarily lobbying anything, but she did seem to show a measure of distress in that there were characters, Islamic characters within England that she felt very sorry that could not be expelled from the country, Hamza being one in particular. Now, she is a head of state. However, when it comes to politics, if she shares any politics at all, that's usually reserved for very private conversations with other heads of state. But why is it that Queen Elizabeth cannot outright come out and come out, outright come out? Oh, that's great, Cal. Great grammar there. Why is it that Queen Elizabeth does not speak politically on secular issues or common issues, as it were?
Well, I think it's more a matter of a tradition than anything else. Now, when you first put this question to me, my response was initially to say what you've just said is that she doesn't get involved in politics. She leaves that to the politicians. And that's not to say that her influence isn't important behind the scenes, but she cannot be seen to be interfering in the way that politics is conducted in an everyday manner in our country. I mean, when she appears in public at all as an ambassador for our country, either at home or abroad, she's very careful not to make any statements that could be construed as taking sides politically one way or another. I mean, she is in a very difficult position because on the one hand, her position is as a defender of the realm, and in fact, I still think she has the title Defender of the Faith, which appears on the coins that we have over here, which does, of course, put her in an awkward position because there are arguably a lot of faiths that are practiced in our country. And if we continue with the fiction that Islam is just another one of those faiths, then she is going to be finding it very difficult to make any public comment at all about it. Of course, Prince Charles, as we know, is a lot more sympathetic towards Islam. I don't know for certain.
Very frightening.
My favourite phrase when it comes to the royal family, if I'm asked my opinion, is that I would bet a £10 note against a couple of manky corgis that the Queen is not impressed with Islam. And the Queen, of course, has corgis as pets, which is why that's relevant.
I believe it was in 2010 that she was visiting Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque, and I was in Abu Dhabi, and she had to don a mask and remove her shoes. I saw the photographs of her, and she looked extraordinarily unhappy about that.
Yes, I'm quite sure. I mean, it's difficult because you're effectively asking a foreign head of state to not just follow local customs, but effectively make herself subservient to a power which she doesn't. In her heart, she's actually constitutionally obliged to protect our country and our Christian faith against the whole concept of Islam. But of course, she can't come out and say that. So I'm not surprised she looked unhappy about it. But she can't say it as much in public. Prince Charles, of course, is a different matter, and I think if he ever became king, he would be far more sympathetic to Islamic causes than any monarch has been up to now. So all we can really do there is just hope that that doesn't happen, or if he does become king, that his reign is relatively short-lived. This is not to say that I'm advocating any kind of violence or anything. You know, it would be a great shame if Prince Charles were to wake up one morning and have a fatal accident while brushing his hair, or if somebody accidentally spread rat poison on his toast. But I'm not advocating anything like that in the slightest.
Absolutely. And Tim, I am telling you, because I'm a subject of the Queen. I'm a subject here in Canada. And when I think about the fact that we're losing one of our greatest monarchs that we have seen probably since Queen Victoria, she has been very stoic. She's a good queen. She's an honorable queen. She's a wonderful head of state. She's a wonderful leader of the people. And I do not want to lose her. And the idea that Prince Charles will be my head of state one day gives me nightmares because of his equiescence towards Islam and how he, well, not only does he talk to the plants, but he talks in the mosques, or I don't know if he does. Actually, I don't know if he does that. Does he I know he visits with imams and has discussions
I don't know if he's ever spoken
at a mosque per se.
Well, I don't believe that he has. Now, if I'm wrong on that score, I'm happy to be corrected, but I think he does confine himself to speaking with imams, and he doesn't put himself in a position where he's perceived to be speaking with any authority in an Islamic place of worship to, you know, to a congregation. I don't believe that has happened.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I don't believe he has either.
However, if anybody knows different, but I don't think that's the case. But yeah, you're quite right. He's sympathetic to their cause, and if he were to ascend to the throne, even though the monarchy in our country has a lot less influence than it did, say, 400 or 500 years ago, I still would set our cause back in terms of containing and controlling the Islamic encroachment in our countries. It would set it back a long way. So quite honestly, I hope it never happens, but you know, that's something we don't have any control over. But it's as well for people to be aware that he is sympathetic, he does have these sympathies, and that we should be very cautious when it comes to how much influence the monarchy can have in our countries. If he were to ascend to a throne, I would be almost at the point of arguing that we've got a good case for turning Britain into a republic and getting rid of the monarchy altogether, but that might be going a bit far.
what worries me, Prince Charles, he is worrisome enough, but what happened this week with the Duchess of Cambridge and Prince William, them visiting a mosque this week and her donning a hijab and him removing his shoes. That really worried me. They, I don't know what mosque they were visiting, but they, it was the, as they, I cannot pronunciate this, Azairakan Mosque, which is the biggest mosque in Malaysia, that can host 12,000 people on Friday prayers. And they visited this mosque, and they took off their shoes, and they, Kate Middleton, she donned the hijab.
Well, I think if you're actually going to go to a foreign country and you are going to say, we will visit this structure in this country, then it's only polite, really, to adhere to the local customs. And if they say, well, women's hair has got to be covered and men have to take their shoes off, then out of sheer courtesy and politeness, that's one thing. But when the members of the royal family actually visit mosques, it's seen in quite a different light by the local population. They don't see it as courtesy and politeness. They see it as Islam in asserting its supremacism and its authority and its dominance over foreign royals. And that
yeah.
in my view, sends out quite a wrong message. However, it's a fine line to take. If you're going to be an ambassador for your country, as Prince William and Kate Middleton obviously are ambassadors for our country, it's a fine
That's
line to
tread. Right.
And I do think that people in this country will understand that if you're travelling the world and you're going to visit foreign countries, then perhaps symbols like this, where you have to take your shoes off or don a hijab, they're going to be unavoidable. You could hardly offend your hosts by saying, "Well, I'm not going to visit this and make a huge political statement about it, or I am going to
mm-hmm.
visit and I'm not going to take my shoes off," which would be even worse. You know,
I cannot argue with that. And I just want to apologize to my listeners for my mispronunciations. It was the Azairakan Mosque in Malaysia, and the event with Prince William and Princess Catherine that took place 3 days ago. I just wanted to ensure that I wasn't totally messing as I'm wanting
well,
to.
Well, I'm sure we all forgive errors of pronunciation. I'm sure I make enough of them in my normal day anyway. So it's secondary.
Are
really
you kidding? You correct my spelling.
Well, if I do so, it's only in the spirit of camaraderie.
Well, you know what? You don't. I. You know what? You inspired me to keep a colloquialism, if we can use it that way. You inspired me. But I was noticing when I was doing my show highlights that I spelled chicken without the C, so it came out chicken.
Well, okay. I mean, one of the first things I remember about you, Cal, when I was looking at some of the things you've written and when we first talked together was the fact that you used the word for the increasing Muslim populations in countries, and you referred to it as an encroachment in our countries. And I thought, that doesn't sound right, because obviously the word most people would use would be encroachment.
And then I thought,
no, that is actually the perfect word, because when people think of encroachment, they think of cockroaches. And what better analogy could you have for an increasing Muslim population than the word encroachment
what I do now is that I spell it encroachment as it's supposed to be spelled, but I put in parentheses in capital letters encroachment, and people love that. They just love that.
And they
have stolen it.
So I thought that was an inspired piece of literary correction on your part, Kel, if you don't mind me saying so.
Oh, thank you, Tim. Before I let you go, I am down to about. Well, actually, I've got quite a bit of time to go here. I saw 4:43. I'm sorry. My apologies. On my end, it's 4:33. So I have plenty of time. But I did want to ask you something else too. You have keenly answered my questions about the royal family and their role in their speaking about Islam. But what about the elections? Your elections are coming up. Your federal elections are coming up in 2016, aren't they?
Well, we call them parliamentary elections over here, but I think it's actually 2015 that the parliamentary elections are over here.
Okay.
It's 2016 in the States, of course. And we have a lot of people are waking up to what's happening with Islam. And the one measure of this, as somebody mentioned to me not long ago, is that only a few years ago, a Muslim could stand up and say Islam is a religion of peace and people would take it at face value and not think too much about it. And now, if a Muslim were to stand up in public and say Islam is a religion of peace, all right, he might not get laughed out of town, but people would pose a serious response to that. And that's one of the things we had in the Oxford Union debate that I referred about, I referred to, which is visible on YouTube. If you have an hour or so to spare, it's well worth watching the Oxford Union debate on whether Islam is a religion of peace. And
that was a fascinating debate. Yes,
it was, and there were a lot of good arguments put against the motion. In the end, the motion of Islam being a religion of peace was actually carried, but there is a fair way to go, I think, to educate enough people in the details of the Islamic ideology so that they come to the conclusion, as they rightfully should, that Islam is in no way a religion of peace. And in fact, one of the things I'm getting off topic a little bit here because you were asking me about elections, and I will come back to that, but one of the things about that particular argument was I felt that the emphasis should have been on, rather than is Islam a religion of peace, we should have said, is Islam a religion? And, you know, whether it's peaceful or not is really secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you could argue, quite successfully in my view, is that Islam is not a religion at all, but a cult. And there's a huge difference between a religion and a cult. And one of the main differences concerns the golden rule, which every world religion has. Now, the golden rule, for those of your listeners who don't already know, basically states that you should treat everybody as you would yourself be treated. And implicit in that statement is that includes people whether they share your religion or whether they don't. You're talking about the whole of humanity. And the golden rule, if you treat people as you would be treated, or conversely, you do not treat people as you would yourself not wish to be treated, that applies to the whole of humanity. And every world religion has the golden rule. And if you talk to a Muslim, if I could sort of quote chapter and verse for pretty much every religion, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Jainism, Confucianism, Buddhism. I could go down the list and actually quote the statements that the founders of these religions made concerning the golden rule. They all pretty much say the same thing, that you should treat your fellow human being as you would be treated yourself. Now, if you say that to a Muslim, he'll point to a hadith, which I think is in An-Nawari. I haven't got the reference in front of me, but the point is that the hadith states that none of you should be considered as a believer until you treat your brother as you would be treated yourself. And the Muslim will point to that and say, there you go, squire. This is the golden rule in Islam, and that just proves that Islam is a world religion with a golden rule like every other world religion. But in fact, it isn't true, because that particular hadith, and in fact the whole way Islam is structured, is that you only treat people equally if they are Muslims. Non-Muslims are to be treated totally differently as second class, well, no, as third class citizens as best, first class being Muslim males, second class being Muslim females, and third class being anybody who's not a Muslim. And that is the complete opposite of the Golden Rule, which is why there's a good argument to be made that Islam is not a religion at all, but a cult. And if that argument were forcefully made and accepted by every person of goodwill, every rational thinking person of goodwill, by which I mean every non-Muslim in the world, if that was accepted as a primary reference when referring to Islam at all, I think we would go a long way to removing the religious privileges that Islam has accumulated as a result. The reason that Islam gets as far as it does is because we treat it as a religion, as we would any other religion, and we think of it as a benign force, a force for good in the world, something that's good for humanity as a whole, where in fact Islam is quite the opposite. So there's a good case, in my view, to be made for Islam not being a religion at all, and I would do it on those grounds. But yeah, to go back to I've got a little bit off topic, and to go back to the
absolutely, Tim, that's absolutely fine, absolutely fine.
I didn't want to stray too far away from that topic, but I felt it was important to elaborate because anybody can say, well, Islam is a cult and not a religion. And I had somebody argue with me and say, well, it's a cult because the members exhibit a cult mentality, which is true, but it's a bit of a circular argument. I think it's much better to argue from the Golden Rule and explain that Islam isn't a religion in the way that we think of other world religions. And if we could treat it as a political ideology, which is what it is first
absolutely,
and foremost, then we could go a long way towards containing and controlling it. While we think of it as being on a par with Christianity and other world religions, it's difficult to control it. But to go back to parliamentary elections,
yeah.
I mean, if you want to pick me up on that subject a little later, that's absolutely fine. But you were asking about parliamentary elections, and I was saying that I think you wrote to me in an email and said, you know, do you think that Islam, the fact that people are becoming more aware of Islam, do you think that's going to be a good thing for parliamentary elections or not? The trouble is that there are political parties now that are starting to make their platform on turning back the encroachment of Islam in our country. And it's likely that they are going to take votes from the Conservative Party. I mean, David Cameron, in my view, is a totally spineless dimmy, and he's a huge disappointment to me and to pretty much every other Conservative that I've talked to in recent months. And I personally would never vote for him again in any capacity.
Oh, absolutely not, Tim.
No, I mean,
that I do not blame you on at all.
Unless it was a vote for him to sort of clean out the toilets at the local town hall, I would not vote for him again, because I think he's totally betrayed the right wing of the British political system. And spineless dimitude expressed in recent events concerning Lee Rigby, as I touched on earlier, saying that Islam had no part to play in this and that it was a religion of peace and all this kind of nonsense that I would have expected better, to be quite honest. And I'm totally
I'll tell you something right now, Tim, is that when he came out the very next day and he was defending Lee Rigby's one killer, and in particular Michael Abadelajo,
yep.
And saying that, oh, well, this was not anything to do with religion, when Abadelajo was actually there in front of the camera holding that cleaver and the knife in his bloodied hands, as you referred later, earlier, in the program, and he came out with that, I just went, dimitude, dimitude, dimitude.
Well, yeah. I mean,
here we go.
Fair, be fair to David Cameron, it's not just him on his own. There's a lot of people in the Conservative Party in the higher echelons who think exactly the same way. And, of course, they're all supported by the mainstream media who refuse to face up to the facts about Islam, who refuse to say anything that could be construed as bad about Islam at all. In fact, anybody in the mainstream media who does say attempt to tell the truth is hounded, vilified and demonized, and runs a real risk of losing their job. And it's not just politicians can lose votes if they say bad things about Islam, but people in the run-of-the-mill jobs, and in particular in the mainstream media, you could lose your job over that. And the same is true.
Oh, I know.
Of other professions.
What's the proper pronunciation of that murderer, that slaughterer, Michael?
Abolejo.
Abolejo. That's the proper pronunciation.
That's right to start with. I mean, somebody said to me, well, you know, that guy's name was Michael, and the other guy who was in the street with him was also called Michael. It was another Michael, and people were saying to me, only partly in jest, well, maybe we should stop all these Michaels on the street, you know. Anybody with the name of Michael.
The other one, we had the Ebba.
Other guy's name was.
Abowell. Michael Abowell. Was the other one. David Cameron coming out with that, it floored all of us. It took us for a real loop, and it must have taken England for a loop. And exactly when your elections come up in a couple of years, that I hope the people of England remember that. I hope the people of England remember that.
But
this is what can happen.
The problem that I wanted to get to, which I was coming round to, I'm sure the people of England will remember this, and a lot of people won't vote. If David Cameron is still in power by the time the 2015 elections come around, I'm sure they won't vote for him. But the problem is that if they vote for one of the other political parties, we've got UKIP coming up on the outside. Now, UKIP is on a platform of withdrawing from the European Union, which I think in itself is actually a good thing. And if we could get out of the European Union, that would be a big step forward, without a doubt. But we've also got people like Paul Weston in Liberty GB. Now, if he became a serious contender to the Conservatives, I mean, I for one would be very keen on promoting his agenda, which would bring the Islamization of this country and the effect that multiculturalism has had on and political correctness and the unrestrained immigration, the effect of all those on this country has been nothing short of catastrophic. The trouble is that all these political parties that spring up with these agendas, yes, they take votes away from the Conservatives, who, in my view, rightly deserve to lose the next election. But if the opposition, by which I mean Labour, maybe in conjunction with the Liberal Party, if they can stick together and not fall apart in the same way, they might still win the next election by default. That's the problem. I think the Conservative vote almost certainly will be split because people are fed up with what they see as the spineless dimitude of David Cameron and the inability of us to make our own laws and to retain our own sovereignty because of the European Union. People are going to be very attracted to UKIP. People are going to parties like Liberty GB. I mean, we're 18 months away from an election, and 18 months is a long time in politics. But that's the big danger that I see, that although the Conservatives may well lose votes, and rightly, in my view, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have a win for the forces of common sense, because there are still so many people on the left who refuse to see the truth. If that's one of the big problems with having a liberal mindset, is that it blurs the concepts of good and evil, right and wrong, and renders people unable to make common sense decisions. That's one of the things I'm always getting into arguments with people on Twitter, because you get people on the left who are totally convinced that their point of view is right and won't be swayed by any arguments to the contrary, and there's an awful lot of them.
Absolutely.
If they
I am down to my last 2 minutes of talking points before I play us out. And guess what I have to do? I have to hop in a car and drive for an hour and a half.
Oh, okay. In which case, I'll just wrap this argument up briefly by saying that, yes, I think people are waking up and I think they are starting to see the truth, but that is a long way from translating into common sense and the restoration of what I see as common sense policies in my country. So I hope we have a miracle in the next 18 months and we do get some common sense policies. But
I'm praying for you.
Yeah.
But before I let you go, I have a very special gentleman in my chat room, and that's Tommy.
Okay.
Tommy English, and he says hello to you, and he looks forward to speaking with you again as well.
Yes, indeed. I've enjoyed the past few episodes of the EDL Blog Talk Radio, where I've been privileged enough to speak and to chat with Tommy and with Jeff Mitchell, and I'm looking forward to it again too. So hopefully hopefully you'll be hearing a little bit more of me over the course of the week if you tune into EDL Blog Talk.
Oh,
you know,
believe me, it is an honor for us radio hosts. We work so very hard at what we do. We work every day. As a matter of fact, some of us work so hard. I can spend like a half an hour up to an hour just seeking out one single soundbite. The work that we do here on radio, the Radio G here, I've got Radio G hat on my mind because I got Vito Esposito, Mamma Mia, No Sharia. I've got Poppy here. I've got Remembrance Soldier. I've got all sorts of people here. I've got Sue from New Mexico, my sweet Sue, listening on the line. But everybody works so very hard at what we do. If we can get the word out, if we can change one mind of one person, then our work is done, Tim. And what you're doing is phenomenal. So we are honored that you are gracing our program.
You're very kind, Kel. You're very kind. But no, seriously, I'm very impressed with what you guys do with Blog Talk Radio. I think Blog Talk Radio is a tremendous medium for getting the word out. And although I've only appeared on, there's your show, of course, obviously, Kel, and EDL Blog Talk Radio.
Please tell me that you'll join me again soon.
Oh, so I certainly will, Kel. I've enjoyed this immensely, and I think it, as I say, it's a fantastic medium, and I would like for lots of people like you to establish shows such as this to help get the word out, because it's something that we haven't had to up to now. I mean, even with the internet only just taking off, Blog Talk Radio is something that's even more of an innovative medium, and I think it's just so good to be able to get the word out to a lot of people in a short space of time. I mean, I can do it with my Twitter feed, but I'm limited to 140 characters per tweet.
Oh, absolutely.
And okay, I broadcast a lot of tweets, as you probably know. In the course of any particular week, I have several hundred tweets which I broadcast, and you know, people might look at half a dozen of those, and that's great if they do. But a medium like this, where we can get over a lot of concepts and discuss them back and to, and develop ideas together over the radio, I think it's tremendous that we can do that. So I look forward to appearing on your show again, and to like-minded shows such as EDL Blog Talk Radio and similar shows. USDL, Jared Winter, that's another one who I think very highly of. Little plug there for Jared. I'd like to get very much more involved, and if you will have me on, then it's my privilege and my honor, Kel, so I would love to do it.
Tim, I want to thank you so very much for joining me today. I have been enthralled by everything you had to say. My listeners, I know those in my chat room, they are just buzzing back and forth. They are just going crazy. I have a funny feeling Vito Esposito of the Radio Jihad Network wants to have a word with you.
All right. Okay. Well, I'm happy to chat to anybody in whatever format they think is appropriate. I mean, you could reach me on Twitter, obviously, if there is a specific website.
And just to let ladies and gentlemen know that I have all of Tim's links up there in my show notes. For those of you who listen in archive and could not catch the links in the chat room, they are in my show notes. So there you go. I've got freedomlovinginfidel at blogspot.ca. I'm in Canada, so it shows up as CA. It'll show up as .com for my American listeners and probably .uk for my European listeners.
.co.uk, I think. Yes.
Yeah. And you can certainly reach Tim at twitter.com/catstrangler101. All are there. Tim, I look forward to speaking with you again.
Yes, and I look forward to it as well, Kel. So I can see the time's ticking away. So once again, it's been a great honor and a privilege talking with you on the show. And a big shout out to all your listeners. Thanks very much for bearing with me on this, and too many of you to mention. In fact, I don't have the chat show window up in front of me. I don't know why that is, but a big shout out to all of Kel's listeners, and hopefully I'll get a chance to talk to you all again. And stay safe, have a good week, and see you soon.
Thanks, Tim. I'll be Skyping with you soon.
Yes, that'll be great. I'll look forward to it.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was my guest, Tim Burton, the freedom-loving infidel from England, taking his valuable time to visit my humble little show. I appreciate that so very much. I want to thank all of you who listened. I want to thank all of you who listen on other devices. I want to thank all of you who listen in archive, and I know you do. Thank you very much for making me feel like I am a voice out there. Thank you very much for making me feel like I am changing one mind at a time and apprising the people of what Islam is. I also want to thank Tommy English because he gave me my new tagline. I'm that infidel fox in the Muslim chicken coop. You know what? I am the infidel your imam warned you about. And we have to remember it's mass Islamity out there, and we have to stop the insanity. Tonight on Radio Jihad Network, Vito Esposito will be right here on Blog Talk Radio at 6 p.m., so make sure you are there to visit Vito's show. I am off to go meet Gilad Shalit tonight. Vito, I will be there in archive later on tonight, baby. I love you guys. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for helping us all out. Thank you so much for spreading the shows that we do. Have a great evening, and I will see you back here on Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, where my guest will be Bonnie of Bare Naked Islam. See you then. Good night. Good afternoon. Good morning. Good day. You don't love the same, the way you did before. Okay. Anne.